Today, we have a guest. Okay, guys, thank you very much for listening to Slick Talk Show. Today, we have a guest. My guest today is Will Treasure. Will is specialized in producing audio documentary. He's qualified as a journalist and written a wide range of publications. These include the Western Mail, the Independent, the Climber Magazine, and UKClimate.com. And he also runs a podcast called Factor 2. And on his podcast, he produced a story called Deep Play with Neil Grinsham. That's a story we'll be discussing today, myself and Will on a Slick Talk Show. How you doing, Will, today? How you doing?
Yeah, I'm not bad. But a little bit sleepy. I've actually been out the Outer Hebrides last week. And we had an epic journey home.
Okay. I mean, right here in Edinburgh, I mean, it's been pouring with rain, you know, just as normal here in Scotland. I don't know if that's the same in Coventry, but it's been a tough day. I mean, pretty much everybody at home right here right now.
Yeah, Coventry's pretty mild. It's not. It's not been raining today. It's nothing like Edinburgh for the rain.
All right. So Will, first of all, you know, thank you very much for coming as a guest today on the Slick Talk Show. For me, it's a pleasure to have you. I had a chance, you know, just to let my audience know, I had a chance to listen some of your work, obviously, on the podcast, Factor 2, great work. Will gives you a chance, it gives you a little bit more details about that, you know, towards the end of the show. But today, we'll be talking about the Deep Play with Neil Grinsham. I mean, that was inspiring. For me, listening to that was it was crazy, man. Can I ask you, Will, do you do climbing? Is that something that you do in your spare time?
Yeah, I've been a rock climber for more than 20 years now. So since I was a kid. And yeah, even from a really young age, it was something I just always wanted to do.
And, I mean, the reason why I'm asking that, would you say, the most reason why I ask that is, you know, if I go on the street right now, Will, and I pick 10 people on the street, and I ask them what they do on the spare time, I'll be very surprised they come back and say, you know what, I'm doing climbing on a Saturday. Or so. I mean, people will probably say, yeah, I walk in the mountain and all that. The story, I mean, for me, most of the time when I see, you know, when you see young kids or young people out there, you know, they play either football, basketball, you know, the more common sport. But, you know, for me, listening to that story was deep to me. Why did you think, what was your mindset there to go and talk about climbing, and especially for that particular one, Deep Play with Neil Grinsham? What inspired you to go and talk to him about that?
So when I started climbing, like in the 90s, Neil was one of the kind of cover stars of magazines, and he was like one of the original professional climbers. And this story really is like his first big thing that he did, and it launched his career really. I guess I was interested because a lot of Factor 2 stories, they're about risk taking and about how it's kind of, climbers do really irrational things and they make strange decisions. And like Neil in this case, in this episode, we were mainly talking about him doing this route called the Indian Face, which is really famous in the UK, among rock climbers at least. And if you go and climb that today, it's still newsworthy. The first ascent was made in 1986, and it was actually reported in The Guardian at the time. And it's just a notorious route because it's so dangerous and so easy to fall off. And Neil had this, I knew that he'd had this really intense experience on it. Because I'd read something that he'd written about it, and I met him about 10 years ago and talked about a little bit about it then. And the bit that really struck me was that he was so driven to do this route, even though it was so dangerous. And he sort of didn't want to do it, but he knew that if he didn't do it, it would just be nagging away. He'd be lying in bed at night and thinking, oh man, I'm going to have to go and do that route. And it's cool that it's still a big deal. Like it's nearly 35 years since it was first done. And I think seven or eight people have climbed this thing that whole time. And they've all had really intense. I've interviewed a few other people who've done that route, and it's something that's stuck with them. It's it's proper, like, from the hardest section of the climb. Basically, if you fall off, you're dead.
Neil, just can I ask again? You know, as a young age, I mean, you had a chance to speak to Neil Grinsham, obviously. I can clearly see, I mean, from his voice, the way he was talking, I mean, you can clearly see as he was telling you the story about the Indian face, you know, he was nervous at the same time. You can feel, I mean, it was just, the story was just beautiful to listen. I just want to know, what's the mindset of, as a young kid, you know, for somebody who wants to be a climber? Is that something that you're saying, like, okay, he knew from a young age that he was going to do something like that? I mean, that's not something, I mean, I've got two boys. I'm not a climber. I don't go to mountain. I don't expect my kids to wake up in the morning and say, you know what, daddy, I want to go and try that. So what's the mindset? How does that go about, you know, when you're young and think about that?
Yeah, I think there's, I grew up in the mountains, and I remember going on a school trip and seeing a picture. I think it was of Doug Scott on Everest, and thinking, wow, that's kind of cool. Maybe I could do something like that when I'm older. But I think Neil started later. I don't think the idea of doing these dangerous climbs, I don't think really entered his head until he was in his 20s. And I guess it's important for people to know that for the most part, climbing's really safe. In Factor 2, we tell stories about the kind of the psychological aspects of climbing a lot, but that doesn't always mean it's really dangerous. There's sort of two, you have this irrational fear in climbing as well as the rational one, and Neil's is about kind of about both of them, I guess, because he's going to do this really dangerous route, and that's a really rational fear. It's really primal, like you're up high, you're going to fall off and hit the floor from 30 meters if you mess it up. But the irrational bit is like, why is he really driven? He doesn't have to do this. He's scared of something else there. And I guess that drive, you know, is it about status or what's driving him?
And when you talk about irrational fear, obviously, and this is where I have to touch on, what was that? That was Rebecca, the psychology coach, obviously. And obviously she touched on that. One of the part was she mentioned that, you know, sometimes, you know, because you've got that fear, and going to the mountain would be for you to overcome that type of fear. And I feel like that's maybe why Neil, you know, once he feels like that, he feels safer, he feels he will overcome all that going to the mountain. Is that the sense? Is that how the mindset of a climber will be, you know, before going, you know, to those type of action?
Yeah, sometimes. I guess I should start by saying, so I interviewed Rebecca, who's a climbing psychologist, and she trains climbers in mental techniques. And I already knew Neil's story, and I knew other people would know about this ascent because it was, you know, 30 years ago. And he's written about it a bit. And I thought it'd be interesting to kind of bring a more scientific perspective to write. I really want to know what drives him to do this, because it seems stupid. But I know from climbing that the reward of doing it can be so powerful, and this experience can really live with you. And I guess it's, for me, it's always about this control. It's a really powerful thing when you're there in this really ridiculous position. You're making really powerful choices, and no one can say, like, you know, you can't do this. There's no one going to stop you doing it. It's this really irresponsible thing, but you have real control over it. And I think that's powerful. And when you're out in the mountains, you're away from everyone and all the normal pressures of life, it's a really freeing thing. And so climbers often say, like, oh, I sort of forget about all my worries while I'm climbing. And sometimes that's because you're focused and you're scared, but sometimes it's just like, it's so absorbing.
God. But just to ask then, just normal people like me, or anybody on the street, obviously, who's not doing climbing, they maybe have some fear or anxiety or anything like that, but you know, the first thing, they're not thinking about going to the mountain, obviously, to overcome anything like that. Or they can have something irrational, you know what I mean? And maybe they try, there's some other strategy that they can use, obviously, to overcome those type of fear. Now, I just want to see the mental part. I was just want to say psychological power, the mental power of a climber. I mean, from what I listened from Neil, it's completely different from somebody like me. I mean, that's the last thing I want to do, you know, go all up to the mountain. I mean, in fact, what I'm trying to ask you here is, for somebody to have that type of mindset, somebody psychologically ready to go all the way up there, does that come down to the fact that maybe his background, his mom and dad used to do that back in the day? Where does that come from, really?
Yeah, good question. I don't know. I don't think Neil's parents were climbers. You do meet a lot of climbers whose parents did the sport, and so they got into it that way. My parents aren't climbers. And like loads of people these days will start out at indoor walls. So if you're in Edinburgh, you've got the Ratho just outside Edinburgh. There's an amazing facility that they use for training the British team sometimes and European competitions and stuff. And it's quite a big step to go from there to outdoor climbing, because indoors is like going to the gym and you need to know things to keep you safe. And it can be a bit scary, definitely. And if you're new to it, it's scary, but you get used to that, and a lot of it is irrational fear, and you learn to deal with, you know, all the safety aspects, and you get comfortable. And then when you go outside, it's there's so many other unknowns. You know, you've got to navigate, you've got to use a lot more complex equipment. You've got to deal with loose rock, or maybe it might be dirty, or sometimes rock faces don't have many features, so you can't anchor your rope and you don't have control over that. So climbers, I think once they step into that, they start making strange decisions sometimes, and it makes sense when you're in that world, but to someone outside it looks ridiculous. And for instance, something I overheard a climber say in the pub once, someone said, "Oh man, is that route really dangerous?" And the climber went, no, it's all right. You'd probably only break your leg." And you think, normal people don't make a distinction between death and breaking your leg. That they're both terrible things. But for a climber, sometimes it's like, oh, well, there is a difference.
Go ahead.
I was going to add to actually, because I'm roundabout way, I'm getting to your question, which is, what does it mean to the person in the street? I think the key thing that you do learn, there might be stuff that scare, everyone's got things that scare them. And sometimes it's right in your face and you know, this is the thing I'm scared of, and you can run away or you can face it or you learn a way to deal with it. Other times that you know you're scared, but you're not quite sure why. And that's a different thing to deal with then. And I think what you learn through climbing is trying to identify those things and trying to manage your reaction to them, because you get the sort of fight or flight response. Or freeze, I suppose that's the third one. And freezing is something that climbers do sometimes when you're that scared you just can't move. But you learn to recognize those responses, and you can moderate your heart rate, and you can, I guess like Peter Pan, you think happy thoughts, but you've prepared for it. And that's what Neil had done on that route, that he hadn't really prepared psychologically for it, but he prepared physically. And that deals with some of the psychological thing, because he knew he was really, really fit and strong. He knew he could climb this route. And what he found, I guess, was as he got higher, he hadn't done the mental preparation. And then that takes a long time. So when it started to unravel near the top, and he's, you know, his B layer was crying, thinking he was going to fall to his death. He's scrabbling around, his legs are shaking. And he's kind of thinking, well, this is a climb that physically is not that hard for him. You know, he's an amazingly good climber, but all the holds, they're just so small and tenuous, and he can't just cling on a bit tighter. Because sometimes different rock types, you can dig your fingernails in behind the holds and you can just hang on for dear life. And on this, you can't do that. And once his brain is starting to recognize the danger and he's not got the skills to deal with it at that point, it starts spiraling out of control. And I guess that's something that people experience that in all kinds of situations in life. You know, if you're in a stressful job, there'll be a point where your work, you've got too much work, or the expectation's too high, or you don't have enough control over the outcome, and you get more stressed and more stressed and more stressed. And we all learn to deal with that in different parts of life. And in climbing, it's just like the consequence is kind of more real sometimes, because the sort of work stress, the weird thing is that the consequence is not, you know, it's not physical danger. It's a different, but it feels the same.
Boy, this is, do you think really somebody like me, okay, I've never climbed before, but do you think I can get to a stage where, obviously, as you mentioned, I can go inside, you know, start doing my prep work, and maybe within 6-7 months, I can go up to a mountain? Do you think that's possible for an ordinary guy just like me?
Yeah. It's important to get the right kind of supervision when you start out, because there's a lot to learn. But yeah, you can learn a lot of good movement skills and safety skills indoors, and you can start climbing outside quite quickly. Traditionally, you know, you have a mental. Go on.
Oh yeah, because I mean, for me, the way I saw that, I mean, the way I see that, especially on TV, I'm just like, you know, those guys just, you know, going up rock by rock, you know, there's no strategy or anything like that. But, you know, listening, Neil, man, I mean, there's a long preparation before you go ahead, you know, to do something like that. Now, there's something you mentioned, and I couldn't get my head around that. He talked a lot about surfers. So you talked a lot about equilibrium. What is it, man?
Oh, yeah. So to a climber, this would be obvious, I guess, if you're a non-climber. Equilibrium is a specific climb in the Peak District, which was first done in the year 2000, I think, and at the time it was the hardest route in the country. And so Neil, basically, I guess that's like the hardest climb that Neil had ever done. So the Indian Face he does is really dangerous, but Equilibrium is, it's probably not quite as dangerous as the Indian Face, but it's still quite dangerous. But it's physically a lot harder. Like, to climb Equilibrium, you need to be a real gymnast. You're talking kind of an Olympic level gymnast to climb something like that. Whereas the Indian Face is dangerous, but I could go out and I could, if I dropped the rope from the top to safeguard me, I could climb the Indian Face. It's hard. Like, I guess I'm an expert level climber, but I'm not world class by any means. I wouldn't be able to do it like Neil did, where I'm in this position of real danger. I wouldn't have the certainty. But yeah, Equilibrium is, British grades are quite funny. Once you reach a certain point with rock climbing grades, we start calling them extremes, which is a bit misleading, because extreme one, E1, it's not a beginner grade, but most people, if you're fit and healthy and you train, you could climb an E1. It's not that significant. When you get to E5, you're talking, that's pretty serious. Like, I don't know, if you were doing other sports, you'd be, I don't know, the equivalent would be like E5, maybe running like 19-minute 5K. It's sort of pretty, you've got to be training hard for that. When you get to E10, which is what Equilibrium is, you're, you know, totally dedicated Olympic level athlete. I guess the difference for Neil there was, on the Indian Face, it all came unraveled because he hadn't done the mental preparation. Whereas on Equilibrium, this is 6 years later, he's learned a lot in the meantime. And so he does loads of yoga, and he learns to meditate, and he's learned a lot about the psychological preparation by then. So, but then when he does that route, he thinks he's kind of had enough of really dangerous climbing at that point. Said on Equilibrium, he was prepared to die to do that route, which is kind of unthinkable for most people to think you're that, it's this little bit of rock. It's not even a big bit of rock. It's like 15 meters high. And crazy.
And you know what? Also, I think on your show, obviously on your episode, he mentioned that he fall. Was he, just double checking it? Was he the Indian Face he fall off?
No, he had to go back. So this is the episode we talk mainly about the Indian Face, but the there are these two other routes, which are, so Equilibrium is the hardest one, and then Meshuga, which I think is a Hebrew word meaning like madman. And that's another one in the Peak District, and he falls off that and hits the floor. He gets caught.
He mentioned he fall and then he black out. Basically, that was his face on, and he black out. And how high was that? I mean, I didn't.
Good question. Yeah, I don't think there's a video of him falling off, but he probably fell about 10 meters. And it's like underneath that climb, it's not like it's a flat grassy landing. It's all boulders and it's quite, yeah. So he was quite lucky.
Boy. And then he came back because what he's saying on that story, obviously it happened. And then, he didn't decide to go back again at some point after his, after he recovered, obviously, from his injury and all that, because he was scared at first, but then decided to go back and face that again. Is that correct, what I'm saying? Or was it then talking about the Indian face at that time?
He is talking about Meshuga. So he falls off and he gets quite a serious head injury. He's got concussion. Yeah. He has dizzy spells. And I think that lasts about a year. But he goes back and climbs it and doesn't fall off this time. He sort of he realizes the mistake he made. Yeah, and crazy, isn't it?
So he decided that, look, I made a mistake the first time. I'm just going to go back and work harder, my mental preparation, get ready and go back again and face that. I'm just saying, anybody else will be like, and that's where Rebecca comes in, because somebody else maybe will be like, I don't want to do that anymore. That's me. It's too tough. You know, I there was a chance I was going to die here. I'm leaving. I'm not going back over there. But Neil decided, look, I want to go and face that again, because mentally I was not prepared last time. Now I'm ready to go. This is crazy. I mean, this is where when I was listening and I was like, God, the mental part of a climber, and I'm looking at my mental part as completely, completely different. And it was just obviously talking about mental strategy, anything that you use on those actions that he does over there. But something I need to ask you, Will, when somebody like Neil goes out there to those rock, does he go with the team? I mean, do you have like a 999 that you can call if you're in trouble? I mean, what's going on, man? Yeah. How does that work exactly?
I guess you climb. I mean, Neil at that point was a professional climber, so if he was doing something hard, he would have a photographer with him, probably, and he'd have someone to hold his rope. And the sort of weird bit for people who don't climb, I guess, is that in British climbing in particular, the expectation is that you use the features on the rock to protect yourself. So you can place little wedges in the cracks and you clip your rope to it. And that's what secures you. And if there aren't any cracks, then you're just expected to climb it without securing the rope. And that's the game. You could do this really safely, but actually the game is to do it safely, but in a kind of dangerous way, which is a bit weird. So Neil, he would have had, I don't know who, it's probably Tim Emmett who held his rope. He would have had kind of trusted people who'd go with him to do that. I think when he did the Indian face, he had a woman called Airlie Anderson, who was an American climber who happened to be living in Sheffield at the time and knew Neil that way. But I don't think she was a particularly experienced climber at that point. And she maybe wasn't. I don't think either of them were kind of suitable to be on the route at that time. But I don't think she was kind of the best partner to have at that point. Maybe later in her career, she more experienced. You have that. And you definitely think about, I guess it's like climbers have quite a dark sense of humor about these things sometimes. What's weird is on these really hard, dangerous routes, it's quite unusual to mess them up. People take it really seriously. And I guess that's why Neil felt he had to go back and do that climb, because he was this sort of celebrated professional climber. And so if he's fallen off and made this mistake, he needs to go back and show that he can do it and he can do it safely, not make that mistake, because that's sort of his, that's kind of his value, to be, you know, he wants to hold himself up to that standard to say, look, I'm a professional. And so,
for those pro climber, once they achieve, or once they don't achieve something like that, that club, I mean, that particular club of climber, you know, there's a respect inside there. Did you have a sense that, you know, you have to go back to gain that respect, obviously, amongst those climber? Otherwise, you go home and then people would say, oh, Neil, you know, you made mistake. You did not achieve your goal. You maybe not was being a pro climber, like, you know. Did you feel like he was forced, like, externally, not just internally? Because I know he talked about, oh, I wanted to go and face that that rock again. But really, was the pressure also coming from outside? You know, your mental part. I'm talking about the people around him, the fans, and all that.
That's good.
Did you have that sense at all?
I hadn't thought about it quite in this way. So yeah, I guess like factor two is often about what are the external pressures, and there's all these things you don't think about. So there was one guy that I interviewed who I knew, and again, I knew the stories because they were quite old ones. But he literally just came up to me in the street and recognized me and said, "Oh, I'd like to tell you a story." And we sat down, and he basically told me the story about how all of these really dangerous routes he'd been doing. This is a guy called Dave Thomas. And he said they were all kind of regaining control from an abusive childhood. So his father was violent. He'd ended up in prison at some point. And lots of Dave's antics, he said, right, while we were recording the interview, he said, it's just kind of suddenly come to me what I was feeling at the top of this climb. As I'm sort of, he was like 60 meters above the sea, no rope on. And he said, yeah, I was missing my dad. And so I don't think he was aware of it at the time, but there was this big external pressure. Well, I guess it was an external pressure, but it was one that he'd internalized. So climbers talk about this thing called authentic desire, where if you're going to do something really dangerous, your motivation to do it has to be really intrinsic. Like, you can't want to do it because you're going to impress Joe down the pub, because that's a really stupid reason to do a dangerous thing. So you've got to have something in your heart that says, yeah, my life is going to be better for doing this. For some reason, I'm going to feel so good. And I guess I felt like that's what Dave, in his episode, he was thinking, he was feeling this authentic desire, like he was just being himself and doing what he wanted to do. But then when he thinks about it more, he's going, actually, yeah, there was this external thing that that he'd become so driven by that it didn't feel external anymore. And I guess I wonder if Neil's the same there, that he feels he has to go back and do this route. I don't think anyone is saying to him, oh, you're useless. You made that mistake. You need to go back. I don't think, you know, climbers are quite a nice bunch of people on the whole. They don't want to see their friends get hurt. So I think I don't think anyone would have been saying that to him. But they'd probably been thinking, oh, will he go and finish it off? Is that sort of the sign that he's mentally strong? And there's a lot of respect in the climbing community for being, you know, mentally strong in that particular way, putting yourself in danger and holding it together. And so, yeah, I guess what I'm saying is that I don't think Neil would have thought there was external pressure. But the reason he wants to finish it off is that deep down, I think that's what he does feel, that it's, it's like an honor thing almost. Like you feel like you're proving it to yourself, but really you're proving it to other people.
Mm. Tell me a little bit, Will. I mean, just if you take somebody like Neil, I mean, you've done climbing. You mentioned you've done climbing, a little bit of that level. What's the mental? I mean, what's the preparation like? You know, for somebody to go and face the, you know, and go and face Indian face, for example. Well, I mean, does that take a couple of days? Does that take a month? Does that take a couple of hours? How does that work, man? How does that work for somebody like Neil Gresham just to get ready to go and face a rock?
Yeah. So I guess physically on the Indian face, it would take you a couple of years to get strong enough. You know, if you had a background in gymnastics or something like that, then you might already have done a lot of the physical training. But yeah, most people, they wouldn't be strong enough. You'd need to be doing, well, I guess the Indian face isn't, it's about 85 degrees. It's not overhanging. So it's really hard, but it's not that steep. So you need to train your calf muscles. You would train your fingers. So I've got a little device that hangs in my doorway at the moment. And it's just like a little bit of wood that's about 2 centimeters deep. And so I train my fingers by hanging on that and watching television, basically. And it's so really basic training. Well, say television, I watch Netflix. So I'm watching Better Call Saul and hanging off this thing. And Neil would just be doing a more extreme version of that. And, you know, the other physical training, he'll be running. He'll be doing all the kind of conditioning training that an athlete would do. Climbers are a little bit, sometimes they're a bit reluctant to call themselves athletes, but at the top end, they're training in exactly the same way. And at this point, you know, 30 years ago, the training knowledge wasn't there. Now it is. And so all of that side of things has become so much more advanced, and the facilities are much better. And then the psychological training that's really still developing a lot. I mean, the physical stuff is too, but I think people are learning a lot more with the psychological training. And I don't know, like there's, I don't know how long that takes. I think some of that has to come from within. I think you have to have the motivation to do the route. And if you don't have that, you can't do the psychological training to get there. But equally, you could go and do loads of climbs that are not dangerous instead. Doesn't mean they're not scary, but they're not dangerous. So you've got a different thing to deal with. You know, you're learning to control the fear. Whereas on the Indian face, you're not just controlling the fear so that you can climb it. You're controlling it so that you move well. Because what happens when you're scared and you're climbing is you start to freeze up a bit and you don't move fluidly. And everything is so much easier if you do it with confidence. So if you've, I don't know if you've ever skateboarded or if you've skied or something like that, people will know that if you go at it with confidence and you're fluid and you move comfortably, it all feels easy and fun. But it's hard to feel confident to do that. And that takes a while. And some of that then is you can do all of this physical training and get strong, but you need to learn the movement and you need to learn it to the point where your body does it automatically, I guess. So like it's like learning a music, like learning a musical instrument. Like I play guitar, and I couldn't tell you how to play things on the guitar, but I could pick up the guitar and play something I learned 20 years ago, and I don't think about it. My fingers just know what to do. I'm not a very good guitarist even, but my fingers know what to do and how the rhythm goes. And you get all that muscle memory. And the thing in climbing, I guess, is it's problem solving. So you've got this muscle memory and you've got lots of different maneuvers that you get used to doing. So you use different parts of your feet. You stand up in this way. So to a non-climber, you have, you know, something you might put your hand on. To a climber, you might have 10 different words for that, describing how big it is, which direction you put your hand on it, whether you use your thumb to press on it, whether you use a single, maybe sometimes you get a single digit, we call that a mono. It might be that you use your middle finger. Maybe it's easier if you use your ring finger. There'll be like loads of detail to do with that. And that takes years to really build up.
Oh man, that's, That's really impressive. But I'm looking myself right now. I'm like, can I go and try something like that? I don't know, man. Maybe with 2 or 3 pints, you know, before going over there, maybe I can.
There is a famous Scottish climber who used to do speed before his ascent, so I wouldn't recommend it.
All right. Anyway, Will, let's go to the next part. Really, first of all, the Neil Green jump story was great, man. I really enjoyed that. You know, thanks for giving me so many knowledge about climbing and all that. Now, I'd like you to give me your point, obviously, how, you know, those type of strategy or mental strategy or psychology strategy from climber also can be used with other sports, for example, football or basketball. Do you think athletes can also use those type of technique, you know, in other sports as well?
Yeah, they definitely can. So I've done a couple of episodes kind of related to that. So one is called Walking the Magic Line, which is another interview with Rebecca, the psychologist from Neil's episode, and with Hazel Findlay, who's one of the top female climbers in the world. And the idea was that Neil's story is about fear and controlling fear. Hazel's is about kind of controlling anxiety. It's not about doing dangerous things, but she's a real expert in it's not even positive thing. It's like the positive psychology of her climbing, so that when you reach a certain point where your physical performance won't go any higher unless your brain follows it. And so she's kind of learned meditation techniques and things so that she can be more in the moment when she's doing that. So like I was saying about picking up a guitar, and I can play tunes that I don't have to think about. And she's doing the same thing on the rock, that she's, you know, her brain is ticking over doing other things. She doesn't need to concentrate on the climbing so much because her body knows what to do, and she's relaxed enough to just let it do that. So Hazel talks a lot about this idea of a flow state, and this comes up in other places, and it doesn't just relate to sports even. So to achieve a flow state, you need to have a challenge that you're motivated for, and it needs to kind of meet your skill set perfectly so that you're totally absorbed in it. And you could get this, I don't know, in an art class. You might get it if you play music. You'll get it, you know, if you play football, basketball, you get it. I imagine Formula One drivers must experience it. And once you're in that bubble, you can kind of sustain the concentration and you can perform better. And you act on instinct. Well, it feels like instinct. It's not. You've trained it. But I guess, so I've worked as a maths teacher for quite a few years, and I see the same thing in the maths classroom as I see in climbing, which is kids who struggle, it's because they're having to think about too many things while they're trying to. So you give them a problem to solve, and they're concentrating really hard on all of the little things they need to do to solve the problem. And the kids who don't struggle so much, they've already mastered those little things, so they don't have to think about them so hard. So your basic numeracy skills, or once they've mastered it, they've got confidence. So then that carries them on a little bit more. But also it means that they're not worried about the goal. They're expecting to meet it. They're not even necessarily that bothered about whether it's going to be achieved. They're not thinking about that. Whereas the kid who's still struggling with their times tables, it's kind of heartless to give them the wrong sort of problem, because they're looking at that thinking, yeah, I could never solve that, because they can't. You know, they're still stuck on 3x7. And in climbing, it's the same. If you haven't mastered the movement skill, and you haven't, you know, or you've got safety skills that you haven't mastered, or some other things, you're having to put a lot of your concentration into the small tasks and not the big picture. And I think, yeah, if you're playing football or other sports as well, you've got the same thing. If you're worried about where you should be stood on the pitch, then you're not thinking about, actually, how am I going to receive the ball? How, you know, who am I going to pass to next? Am I going to run? Yeah. Am I going to shoot? You've got too many things to think about. So when you train the physical side so that that's automatic, And then you can train the mental side as well so that you're calm in the right situations. And, you know, you can literally control your heart rate so that you're calm. I think that applies everywhere. So that I think that probably the best example I've got, I interviewed a guy called Jerry Moffat, who was the first World Cup winner in climbing. So climbing competition now is a really big deal. It's in the Olympics next year. Jerry, back in 1989, won the first ever big international comp that was held in Leeds. And he'd been doing competitions for a while, and he was so he wanted to be the best climber in the world, and he felt like he couldn't say that he was until he'd won this competition. That was his big goal, and he kept going to other smaller competitions and doing really badly, and he just said he was having a meltdown. And he couldn't understand it because he was like, but I'm so good. I train harder than everyone. He was given a book by his parents, by Lanny Bassam. And it was about, I think it was an Olympic pistol shooter, something like that, who had struggled with the same things and trained themselves so that they could be really calm and just, you know, win this competition. And so he started putting that into practice, and then it resulted in him winning in Leeds. And it was simple things. So it was, he put post-it notes all over his house that were like positive messages. So he'd open the fridge and it'd say, "Hey, you're Jerry Moffat. You're great. You're the best climber in the world." And like,
that's crazy.
Yeah, it is bad, but it worked. And he had so much confidence in himself. And he said when he was actually there in the competition, then he had a routine, and he knew he was going to do this, he was going to listen to this this thing, and he was listening to the audio tape of the book in the competition and like ignoring everyone else. And he said at other times he'd gone in there and he'd been kind of intimidated by the other guys there, and just on that day he felt so confident then. And he said he was sat there with his headphones on, and then he went out. And he just said, I just knew I was going to win. And like it was, and he climbed so fluidly. And so the way a climbing competition like this works is you've got a single, this was the final now. So they've got one route up a sort of 20 meter wall, and everyone has to try and climb it, and whoever gets the highest wins. And so obviously the ideal scenario, the winner gets to the top and everyone else falls somewhere. And, Jerry is so in the bubble on this route that he's the last one out, and he climbs it, and he's climbing perfectly, and the crowd are watching. It's quite a big crowd there, and cheering. And he gets to the point where he's got one more move to do and he'll win the competition. And he does the move and the crowd's cheering, and like to anyone else it's obvious he's won, and he doesn't know because they don't let them watch the other competitors. But you think, well, you can hear the crowd. You know you've won, surely. But he's so absorbed in what he's doing that he cranks all the way to the top, and he gets to the final hold and actually wins he doesn't just win the competition, but he's the only person who finishes the problem. And he doesn't even notice the crowd the whole time because he's trained himself.
He's so focused.
Yeah.
Exactly.
But like, you know, exactly. Lionel Messi or someone like that must be in that same bubble when they're performing.
Oh, most definitely. I mean, great story, man. Will, great story. Will, just a quick question there. Obviously, you mentioned about Olympics, Olympic Games, you know, coming up next year. In climbing, who will be the people? Who are the people we should be looking for here, especially representing the UK? I should be looking forward to see, man, for next year.
At the moment, there's only one British climber qualified, Shauna Coxey. And she stands a pretty good chance of getting a medal. She's been a medalist in the World Cup competitions in the past. The format is a bit strange at the Olympics. It's not a format that was ever done in climbing competitions before. So you have to do three events. You do a speed climb, a bouldering competition, which is without ropes but on quite small problems, and then a lead one, which is on a bigger wall. It's sort of 20 meters high. So Shauna Cox is the one to watch. There are a couple of other British athletes who might qualify. There's a guy from Edinburgh, Will Bosey. There's a girl in London, Molly Thompson-Smith, who has a chance. She's really strong climber. I think it's unlikely she'll qualify, but she's got a chance. Will Bosey is strong enough. He needs a bit of luck. So the only place left for him, he has to win the European Championships to qualify. A big ask. But yeah, on the world stage, the big name is Adam Ondra, who's from the Czech Republic.
I'll be tuning to watch that. And over the past few Olympics, I can tell you right now, this is not something that, you know, I was watching back in the days, but certainly I'll be definitely after listening to your show, definitely you have my attention now when it comes to climbing competition in the UK, and especially with Olympic coming through as well. And just to ask again, in terms of Olympic game, you didn't mention about the former. Do they have a woman competition climbing and men, or basically is it mixed altogether?
They're separate. They're separate men's and women's. But it's an interesting question in climbing that there aren't as many women who climb, although it is growing. But there's kind of a theory in climbing that maybe it is a sport where actually, if there was parity in numbers, the men and women at the top of the game would be a similar level. So, yeah, at the moment they're separate. It'd be interesting to know. They have separate climbs.
Because I'm looking at the gender side there. I don't think, I think the technique, from what I'm listening, for what I understand about climbing, is really about getting the technique right, you know, getting your mental right. Really, psychologically and mentally, your strategy need to be correct. So I just don't know how the gender will play a role there. That's why I'm asking the question.
There are still... So I interviewed one of the sort of top female climbers in Britain a couple of years ago, and her. So you still have gender differences at the moment. There are women who've climbed some of the hardest routes in the world, not quite to the same level as some of the men. But that, again, that might just be a numbers thing, and it's power to weight. So actually, if you're as a woman, you might be smaller, you might not be so muscular, but that means you've got less of you to move around. You probably carry more body fat, and so men can carry a really low body fat and still be healthy, whereas for women that can cause a problem. And there's certainly a couple of female climbers who've had issues in that regard. There might be male climbers who've had some problems as well, but have kept quiet about it. The sort of weight aspect is an interesting one in climbing.
That's good, man. I mean, first of all, I will thank you very much again. For anybody out there listening, Will Treasure, I mean, you have to tune in on Factor 2 podcast, you know, from Will Treasure. Great story, great producer. I've been listening to Deep Play with Neil Gresham. I'll be listening or see Walking Line, I think.
Walking Line.
Walking Magic Line, I think that's the one. That's the next one. It's basically on my play right now, man, that I need to listen. Now, you know, for my audience out there, Will, you know, can you tell us where we can check you out, you know, Facebook, you know, anything like that you want to throw out there?
So Factor 2 has a Facebook page, which if you search Factor 2. We're on Instagram as well. That's factor.2. And you can find me on Twitter, where I tweet about other stuff unrelated to that, as well as I'm Treasure Wild on Twitter.
Okay. Guys, thank you very much. Really, Treasure, was a pleasure, man, to have you today. And pretty much, I hope I can get you again, you know, one of these days, you know, back here, you know, to talk to me. Maybe before the World Cup or any Olympic Games, so to talk a little bit about climbing, just so that I can share that with my audience, because I mean that's not something that people basically that's not something like people talk about all the time. But and I think the mental strategy, psychologically, and the fear factor and all that is so interesting when you listen to the climber or you listen to, you know, coach, the psychology coach talking about that. And this is why I thought it would be great for my audience to listen and listen to your knowledge, listen to you. And if there's any interest, obviously, about climbing, it would be best, obviously, to go and listen and Real Treasure. And you're definitely going to find some more contact over there about Neil Grinsham and any other climber. So, guys, thank you very much for listening again today. And I hope you stay tuned on tomorrow's Slick Talk Show. Thank you very much and good night.